the front page, and then I'm like, well, now I don't want to give you my money for a lecture because I don't want to support the, I don't.
Okay, tell them that. Be very clear about that. Tell them I'm 100% behind your sentiment. They're not thinking. That's also in the letter to Marseille. The Maimonides, you know, three considerations for the only things you should accept as true. So that's a very, you know, potent. You know, the article, you know, apropos to this very specific, you know, phenomena, this mysticism.
I will definitely send that along to them, and I'll attach your name. Because I know that the response would be something like, well, we have a rabbi endorsing this. So I'd like to point out that, well, yeah, and I can drag out this rabbi, but that's not, you know, it's not just stacking up rabbis.
Yeah, rabbis could be wrong, period. Let's see if the idea is true.
Exactly.
Does it conflict with the reality? Is it evidenced at all? And if it's not, what are you promoting something which you want to tell me, well, maybe it is true, or maybe Jesus is true too. So you have to shut down Noahide nations. So whatever the angle is. Well, it's against Torah to make a statement to, you know, it's first of all, it's maybe it's not thievery because the person's ignorant. So if a person's ignorant of something, so he can't be malicious. Malicious is when you're making a conscious, you know, violation, you know, perpetration. But
Hi, Rabbi.
Good morning, Darrell. How you doing?
I'm okay.
Good.
How are you, Rabbi?
All right. You were just saying that if a person is telling you that they'll read your name and tell you something, so that's crazy. There's no effect of your name and in reality. It's the same thing as astrology.
Yeah, I was listening. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I know that last week we finished the Sefer, and I had a question from 2 weeks ago. I don't know if I'm allowed to ask now if you wanted to cover some other ground.
Well, yeah, we can do that right now. Let me just make sure, you know, I was just in the middle of the point with Jim and Nachshon, so let them finish up, and then you can ask your question next.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Jim and Nachshon.
No, by all means, I understand, and I'm going to pass that along.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's... Even the rabbi. This guy's an Orthodox rabbi? This guy Katz?
Well, I've never heard of him. Like I said, I just stumbled on this by accident. I'm going to assume so because I think that's who they maintain their relationship with. The Noahide nations are the Orthodox community. But I don't know him.
Yeah, I mean, I would also tell them, you know, again, you can quote me, that not just to address this specific problem, but they accepted this and they posted it on the site because of the way they're thinking. So their thinking is out of line. So they have to really go back and realign their thinking with, you know, what's true. And again, that letter from Maimonides to the community in Marseille will be helpful, but you really have to have them focus. If something is not proven, they should not accept it and certainly shouldn't be promoting it. It doesn't matter, you know, names, reputations, all these things. I mean, it's common in the Jewish world, too. I just wrote a letter to the Jewish press and some other paper right here that, you know, they have these people that they call themselves Kabbalists or rabbis or rebbetzins, you know, the females, and you know, they're really just trying to make a buck. But, you know, the newspaper is also wrong because they take the money for an ad, and the ad says this rabbi or this Kabbalist is coming from Jerusalem, you know, all of a sudden, oh, Jerusalem, there must be something special and holy about them, as if, you know, a person can't be a fool living in Jerusalem. And they take the money, they promote the ad, and they tell them that, you know, this, they're basically going to do idolatry. That's what this woman said, that she pours lead, and the way the lead, the molten lead, drips, whatever, so that now is going to be indicative of the person that's in front of her. You know, it was just purely idolatrous. And these exact cases that Rambam actually, you know, isolates in chapter 11 in Laws of Idolatry. So you see, it's just a loss of learning and attachment to the, you know, the mystical and wanting a quick fix that's causing all these things. So there's no shortage. So, but, you know, but I responded to it. I mean, you got to respond to these things. And all right, enough of that. All right, Daryl, you had a question.
Yeah, actually had two questions. In reference to the idolatry, someone had sent me an email about saying a prayer, which is, you know, in English, it was like an English version of some of the prayers that we ask for Parnassa, and that God should heal us and remove all sickness and struggle and anguish from everybody, from our families, from our friends, from our enemies. You know, not enemies that are truly our enemies, but enemies that people that we dislike because we had a disagreement.
Right.
So that's permitted to say that prayer, right? I think there's something similar in Shemona Esrei and Avina Markino and some of the other prayers, right?
Well, the rabbis formulated how we ask for our requests, and that should be placed in the Shemona Esrei, not outside of it. There's a formula.
A single blessing, like a one line, should not be said separately.
Yeah, because we have a formula. You know, halacha, Jewish law, has parameters for a reason, that we shouldn't start making up new ways of doing things. It's very important that we adhere to them strictly. It's so important that God gave the rabbis the permission to set up fences against all the 613 laws. That's what the rabbinic laws are all for. They can only be made not to add something new, but to protect and keep, you know, intact the pure laws. So doing something like this is really you know, going against the at least the philosophy of trying to, you know, be in line with the set system.
So the words, if the words are formulated similar to that in Shimon Esrei or Avinu Malkeinu, it should just be said in those prayers.
Exactly.
And if they're exactly the, like, can you read just one line of one of those prayers? Like, can you say there's a bracha before Modim or a part of before that where you ask for, you know, sustenance from the eggs of life to the steer? Can you say that prayer separately?
What are you talking about?
It's a prayer in the Shemona Esrei.
But you shouldn't institute anything outside of the parameters. Again, you know, we have three times a day that you pray. Now, you do have instances in the Torah where Esav was chasing after Jacob. So at that moment, he prayed to God. But again, he didn't have a, you know, the law didn't exist yet. There was no such thing as Judaism yet. So that's, but maybe the philosophy behind what he did is that a person's in dire need. So then maybe he can say an additional, you're allowed to do that. It's called a tefillah nadava, which means that you're being, you're adding on an extra prayer during the day that you're allowed to do if you can put something new into your Shemona Esrei. I mean, you still have to say the Shemona Esrei. But let's say a person's like, you know, can't and is in dire need, so I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, saying, you know, God, help me right now, I'm about to die, something's, you know, save me from this, you know, I see that my car is sliding off the road, and in 10 seconds I'm going to go off the cliff over there, the brakes aren't working. So there, you know, a person, you know, has those rights to, you know, something very tragic is going on. He doesn't have the option to do Shemona Esrei at that point. So then the Torah also has an injunction that when you're, as things are out of your control, you're coerced, then you're exempt. So when you don't have the time, and, you know, you get 10 seconds, so then you're not bound at that point to, you know, try to get to a minyan or to, you know, to pray the whole thing.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
I'll make the other one very quick. We were talking about the miracle of the Luchos, the tablets. last week and the week before, and also in the Jewish Times. And on the tablet, there's one thing that says to honor the Shabbos, right?
Right.
The Sabbath is one of them.
Right.
And then that's between God and man. And then there's between man and man on the other five, right?
Is yeah.
that how it works?
Yes.
So if someone is being Mechalal Shabbos, you're allowed to, in private or not embarrassing, you're allowed to correct him and tell him he's doing something wrong. You're allowed to warn him once. Because if two people are there, then he's kind of Nisa. He's put to death, but we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, we don't have the courts.
No official date in.
Yeah,
I understand it correctly.
Yeah, you're supposed to tell a person about Torah laws. If they're, even if they're not going to listen, I believe you still tell them once, to the point that they're going to hurt you. Then you stop. If you see you're putting yourself in danger by warning somebody, so you're not obligated to do that. That's by
all of the Ten Commandments?
Yeah, all Torah, all 613. It's the rabbinic laws that the rabbis say is better off, let the person sin unknowingly than sin purposefully, because if you tell him that something is prohibited and then he keeps doing it, now he's sinning purposefully. That's more of a corruption of a soul. But that only applies by rabbinic laws. But by laws that are the 613, there we don't have the principle better off that he's transgressing by accident and not purposefully. There you have to tell him that he's doing something wrong.
What about a relative? Like, let's say you.
Doesn't matter.
Even your parents, you can tell them if they're doing something.
Yeah, of course.
Against Torah law.
Yeah, you do it respectfully.
And you should only do it one time. And
yeah, one time it should be sufficient for an intelligent person. They hear it.
Uh-huh.
They hear it. They're not going to forget it.
And what about a moron?
Well, yeah, it's not going to help it.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
Yes.
So, if the idea is that you're better off if you're going to violate a rabbinic commandment to do so without realizing you're doing it?
Yeah, the rabbis say that it's better off that you don't risk the person violating more severe. Let him have less of a punishment. So, if you know that you're not sure whether the person's going to listen or not, if you know the person's going to listen to you, they respect you. So even by rabbinic law, it makes sense. Tell them they're doing something wrong so they stop. Because then they're not going to do any infraction. But if you're not sure whether the person will cease from the infraction, and it's rabbinic, so then don't tell them. It's better off because maybe they'll keep on doing it. But if they keep doing it after you warn them, now it becomes purposeful. And that's a worse corruption of the soul. You don't want to do that to a person. So it is a funny thing. But what's your question?
Well, wouldn't that logically suggest that the best course of action is not to teach anybody rabbinic law at all? Because then if they violate it, it will be by accident, not on purpose.
Not to teach it to them at all. Well, one problem you have with that is that a lot of the rabbinic is explanation. A lot with the rabbi, well, that's not rabbinic, if they just explain the Torah law. Let me think for a second. Well, I would say there's a big difference, and that is that when you're teaching rabbinic law, you do it because the assumption is a person is listening and he's attending a class, or he's listening to you, speak because he wants to follow the Torah system. There is rabbinic law and there is Torah law. What you have in our case is when you have, a person's daily life, and he makes a mistake. People make mistakes all the time. People let the emotions get them, or they forget something. So there, we're talking about when the person slips up. We're not talking about as a pedagogic approach, your method of education. So there's two things. In terms of method of education, you teach them everything, of course. In terms of when a person's in their practical life and there's a slip-up, then, in terms of behavior, then that's the question we're dealing with. So there's a big difference. you know, in terms of the system being, you know, promulgated and people being presented with what the complete Torah system is, there you have to teach them everything. In terms of when in daily practice, the person slips up, then you have to assess what would be better in that given situation. Make sense? Okay. All right, so we're going to do some review on Kehelas. And again, next week we're not going to meet next week. We'll resume the week after, just so we have that down. All right, so Kehelas. So I jotted a few notes down. And just to pick up some points, you know, from the beginning. So, for example, in 1:3, we talked about true accomplishment in terms of the concept of man and his need for accomplishment. So you see that right off the bat, we're talking about understanding the human disposition. And it's give you insight right off the bat of what are the major aspects of the human psyche. So there he says, what addition there'll be to man, but all his labor under the sun. So he says that because accomplishment is a very big thing in a person's life. And much of man's energies are geared towards that. And of course, that's tied in with what emotion? So that's tied into ego. The person's sense of self that gives them a drive. The way we're designed is that we are motivated to do things, and ego is a necessary component. The only problem is that he says at the end of the verse, and he says this, of course, many times throughout the book, under the sun. What benefit is to man with all of his labors that he does under the sun? So a person just reading it, you know, reading it casually, is going to... The person's going to say, you know, well, what do you mean? The person has to do things. He has to accomplish. But you see how subtly King Solomon says it, that it's under the sun, meaning the earthly existence. If we're just assessing, and that was also another major thing we said many times throughout the years, is that if man assesses a value purely in what he sees on earth, and that's his own, that's the closed, you know, like an encapsulated sphere of considerations, is only what a person sees is happening here. So then he'll, of course, come away with very incorrect opinions. Like he says later on, he says in chapter 2, verse 4, that death meets everybody. Right, I'm going to die like the fool, like the wicked person. So what benefit was there? Let me see if that's correct. No, 2:14, not 4. He says, the wise man, his eyes are in his head, but the fool, he walks in darkness. And I know that one event will happen to all of them. And I said in my heart, like what happens to the fool will happen to me. Therefore, why did I become wise anymore? But then I said in my heart that this is foolishness. So another main point we said throughout the book was that many times when he makes a statement, King Solomon makes a statement, it's not his opinion, but he is vocalizing the view of the masses. And he does this in order to get people to agree that they have that sentiment themselves. Oh, it's only once the person will admit that he has a problem, then he can have a solution. Right? The first step to a cure is admitting he has a problem. So that's what he does. But then he says at the end of the verse, but I know in my heart that this is foolishness. Meaning that very statement, he then says, that's the view of the masses. But it's not so clear, because he wants people to think that he has this opinion, and people feel it's now safe to come out of the closet if the king is vocalizing the same opinion or sentiment that they have. So he does that throughout the book too, his method of getting people to admit. So you see, what he's really trying to do is not just give abstract concepts, but actually help a person get to a better life. So he uses psychological ploys in order to do it. He applies the very understanding he has of human nature in the book itself. It's not just a description of psyche, of man, and the workings, the aspirations. It's not just an abstract listing. Right? It's not just his experiences. But what he's doing with the actual book is working with the reader and helping the reader to perfect himself. Okay. So that was about, a very important theme, that a person must not assess the value of anything based solely on the earthly phenomena, the earthly existence of man. Okay. So now back to chapter 1. He says, in verse 4, a very important statement. A generation goes and a generation comes, and the world exists eternally. Right? And this he says on the heels of verse 1-3, where he talked about what benefit is there to man. So right after he talks about the benefit to man, then he talks about the generations come and go. Why does he say that? So what he's telling you is that a response to 3. A person is looking for accomplishment. But look, it's not only a person that comes and goes, generations come and go. So he's trying to undermine the targeted venue where a person wants to seek his accomplishment. Don't look for accomplishment to be earthly. Generation comes and goes. You have a need for accomplishment. He talks about that in 3. But then he tells you, he curtails that. Okay. So there's an important thing. I'm not sure if we discussed it. You'll tell me. But on this very point, that generation comes and goes. So when a person attends a funeral, I think the person, only the loved ones, the relatives say it. So one of the verses that they say when they admit to God's justice, it's called Tzidik Adin. You affirm God's justice, and I believe that's one of the reasons a person recites the Kaddish prayer when they're a mourner, because a person can have a certain aggression towards God that a loved one was taken. So they do just the opposite. They affirm God's greatness, and they shouldn't let the loss cause them any aggression towards God. Now, part of what the person does is they make a statement, and it's an amazing statement. And it says, and this I believe you say this graveside, and you say that right afterwards. So one of the statements you make is that man, whether he lives a year or he lives 1,000 years, what benefit is it to him? The same word, Yisron. My Yisrono. What benefit is it to him? He is like one who never existed. And then it says, blessed the one who kills and resurrects. So that's one verse in the Tzidik Adin, when we at graveside. But it's an amazing statement. Did we ever discuss this before, by the way?
No, I don't think so.
No?
I find it very interesting.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating point and very subtle. I had a very hard time until I realized that I was trying to define something that was already defined, meaning... What does it mean that if a person lives a year, or if he lives 1,000 years, what benefit is it to him? He is like one who never existed. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. living the right life.
No, even if a person lives the right life. That doesn't say there's no... We're not talking about a wicked person. Any person.
The quality of the life, isn't it?
No, it says if a person lives a year or if he lives 1,000 years. What benefit is it to him? Doesn't say he lived a bad life. Yes, it's a difficult statement read just literally.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a literal read, but you have to understand what the point is. Meaning to say that if a person lives a year, if he lives 1,000 years, so there's no difference. Meaning, if he dies, so what benefit is it to him? So, what does it mean? What benefit is it to him? Now that the person's dead. So this statement in a sitter is saying there's no benefit to him. He is just like a person who never existed. Meaning whether you lived a year or you lived 1,000 years, after you die, you're like a person who never existed. If what? If there is no continuation of the soul. That's why it ends off, blessed is the one who kills and resurrects. I mean, it's only because there's an eternity to the soul that there's any value. If, however, there is no such thing, and a person lives a year, if he lives 1,000 years, once those two people expire, they're equal. Why is that? Would you agree with that, first of all, or not? Or would you say, no, the person lived 1,000 years had it much better? What would your thinking be? Think about it for a moment.
Where I read it, but it stated that the rabbi stated that if life doesn't continue afterwards, the whole existence here.
Yeah, but the question is why exactly?
Yeah, that's why.
That's my question.
I'll take issue with the question.
What's that?
I'll take issue with the question.
Go ahead.
If you have people standing side by side. And they've each lived for 20 years, and for some reason they know one of them is going to die tomorrow and the other is going to live for another 100 years, I don't think they will find those choices ambivalent.
No, we're not talking about during life, though. We're talking about whether a person lived a year or he lived 1,000 years. Now, once they're both dead, so the statement is, either one is like they never existed.
Time is no issue, is what it's basically saying. Time's not important.
Well, that's too general.
Well, the time, whether it's large or small, whether they live good or bad, it's irrelevant.
Okay, why?
It's irrelevant to the purpose of life.
Why is it irrelevant? That's what the statement is saying. It's like a person who never existed. Whether you lived a year or 1,000 years, what benefit?
A person, right? It doesn't say the neshama.
No.
So it's talking about the physical being.
It's talking about if there is no continuation of the soul. If there's no continuation of the soul, can we say, in retrospect, that one person had it better because he lived longer?
Sorry, I just put it on mute. Understood. It's in retrospect, once they're gone, then it's as if they never were.
Okay.
So, does anybody talking about the soul? Some souls are cut off.
No, we're talking again. Let's be clear. I'm talking about a case where there's no continuation. Whether a person lives a year or 1,000 years, it's like, what benefit is it to him? It's like he never existed.
So that's talking about a case when...
There's no soul. There's no continuation.
Continue.
There's no continuation. The case that I'm presenting you, so you can't change... You can't change...
Obvious.
What?
That's when basically a year, 1,000 years, a million years, you could even say that... If he doesn't do the right things...
No, even if he lives a proper life. Again, even if he lives a proper life.
But did you just say that the soul...
In the case with... Let me give it to you again. Whether a person lives a year or 1,000 years. The statement is, what benefit is it to him? He is like one who never existed. In the case where the soul, we're saying in this case that the soul does not continue at that point.
Oh, it means that once he's gone, it's like he never existed, meaning he
why is that?
That's change things. He's at the
okay,
stage
so
whether he exists as the soul or the soul is cut off. That
why is it, gone. Again, why is it like he never existed? The guy lived 1,000 years.
He can't change anything now. He's gone.
Who was it? We're not talking about changing things.
All his works will fade away. Anything that he accomplished will eventually...
Let's say it doesn't fade away. The statement doesn't give that. The statement doesn't say that it's because it fade away. It's true, we can theorize, but I want to go to the core over here. I know, but that's...
I don't understand that.
We're not talking about the works.
Right? Whatever their findings were, whatever their accomplishments, whatever they...
Okay, so why is it like he never existed? How can we make the statement that it's like he never existed? You're strengthening the question.
Right.
Okay.
I'm confused. I need an answer. I really don't know the answer.
Right. It sounds counterintuitive. There you are. There you are. Exactly.
The question is kind of a strange one because you're saying, well, if I had one person that lived an hour and one person that lived 1,000 years, but they are both dead, and assuming there's no life after death, then you're saying it doesn't really make any difference to either one of them, but there'd be a difference in the sense that there's no conscious existence or consideration of that existence.
What was the last thing you said? Subconscious what?
There's no conscious consideration of that existence.
Well, they're not there anymore, like you just said. If we say that that everything ends, so then what we're basically saying is if something is not eternal, it's useless. It's waste. It's like it never existed. It doesn't matter how long something was transient. It doesn't matter how long a person lived, whether he lived a year or a million years. If it comes to an end, it's like they never existed because there's no person anymore. It's a hard thing to get your head around. I had this numerous times. I had this conversation, and we're trying to define why is it. Meaning, why is it that there's no good in the fact that they lived that 1,000 years? At least they had all that time. They did good. They gave charity, whatever it was, kindness to others. And enjoy the family and all. And how could you say that there's like the person who lived 1,000 years is equal to a person who lived for 1 year or a moment? Because the answer we're saying is, it's clear. Since neither one exists anymore in this scenario, you can't speak of the person anymore. Well, at least he had a good life. What do you mean? There's no he anymore. So it ends up to be that unless there is an eternity to the soul, and that's how the verse concludes, if we say that there's no soul, so then you're right. It doesn't matter how long a person lives. But it's only because God kills and he resurrects. Now, that could be a benefit that the soul can endure in a positive state. That's the only reason why that you can say that something is really has a value. Because value, by definition, means it's eternal. It's synonymous.
I strongly disagree.
So because why? Again.
Well, I mean, if I'm understanding what you're saying unless there is some eternal, then everyone's life means nothing and nothing. because somebody figured it out, and it saves millions of lives, and somebody did some things back in their lifetime that have affected how we live right now. And so the accomplishments that they made absolutely do affect the world we live in, because we live on the shoulders of those people who went before us.
Yeah, but you're making one big mistake. If the scenario is that there's no eternity to the soul, so who cares that I made penicillin 300 years ago and now somebody today is living? That person living today longer is going to die too. We have to be consistent with the value system. If we're saying that the value of the one who made penicillin, let's say he made no penicillin, let's say he didn't do any good that he left behind, then you'd agree with me, it sounds, that his life was worthless. Oh, but since he did make something that's going to help others, so now there is a value. Yeah, but if those people also expire and they have no continued soul, so we're back to square one, aren't we?
Not the way I'm seeing it. I mean, every one of us that exists today is affected to one degree or another by stuff that people did before us, and the quality of the life that we have and the ability to live and the ability to drive a car and everything else that we do, and have books that we can read and study, is because some people developed all that technology, if you'd call it, before us.
I agree.
So, if none of those people lived, my life would be extraordinarily different.
You're right, but let's say your life was only for 1 hour. Would it really matter about all those contributions of penicillin and automobiles and flushing toilets? Let's say you lived for only 1 hour. Let's say every human being lived for only 1 hour. Let's make it better. Let's say every human being only lived for 1 minute. Would all the things that the previous generations did, would it really matter for beings that come into existence and 60 seconds later, they expire?
No, not when you put it that way.
I don't understand what the point is here.
The point is that if something does not have, if a person doesn't have an eternal existence, so if he's going to come to a screeching halt, whether it's in 1 year or 1,000 years, it doesn't matter. Because now that thing, that soul doesn't exist anymore. That person doesn't exist anymore. If that's how life is, which it's not, of course. We're trying to say how vain the physical existence is of a person if there's no investment in the soul. That's really what we're saying at the Tzedek HaDin, when the person, you know, passed away and we're attending the funeral. So we're making a statement that there shouldn't be such a problem to us that their physical existence is over. We should now focus on, and it's hard because you relate to a person physically with your feelings, your love, your whole life with a person. And therefore the rabbi saw fit that there should be a focus on this person is not really gone. Don't feel so bad. We're the ones that have it bad because we're going to miss them. They're now in a better state of existence. But don't look at their life as really being their entire existence, and now it's over. That's a false view, is what the rabbis are trying to imbue us with at that moment when we lose somebody. But they're talking from a very fundamental idea, that if there is no continued existence, so then whatever a person does, if since it's coming to a complete end, it doesn't matter. Now, your argument, Doug, was that, well, look at all the contributions they're leaving to the people after them. They're making their lives much more improved. Now, I agree. During their existence, there is a better existence that they have, but does it really matter when you measure the value of somebody whose existence was just a bleep on the radar of all existence, of all time? A person's life is like a little bleep. That's it. That's why I brought it down to, let's say a person only lives for 60 seconds. But he had an automobile during that 60 seconds, and he had, you know, flushing water, he had plumbing, he had penicillin. So we're looking at such a small span of time, I think it highlights the temporal state, which is really, who cares that a person had an existence at all if it's only 60 seconds? Now, we shouldn't be fooled by the fact that the person lives 60 years or 1,000 years, because if it's coming to an end, so what really was the whole purpose of that time? It ended up there was no real purpose to that person, because purpose, I'm trying to give you an idea here, that purpose or value by definition means that it continues, it endures, it's eternal. If something comes to an end, it really, it's, you know, after the fact, there's no real purpose to that thing. And even if they left over things to other people, if they're also, those people that are the beneficiaries of that penicillin, but if their span of time is also just a 60-second bleep, you see where I'm going with it? Right. Okay.
I'm confused also. I have to go with this guy right now because I am totally confused. So let's say a person lives 60 seconds. Let's say a person lives 60 years. It's still the same thing. You're saying it's still the same thing, but I don't.
If there's no continued existence afterwards, so it was useless.
Yeah, but if let's be
You're breaking up. I can't hear you. I can't hear you at all. Everybody else still there? Hello? Hold on, Rivka, stop. Rivka, stop, if you can hear me. Stop talking for a second, Rivka. Hold on. Can anybody else hear? I just want to see if it's my line or if everybody else is having a problem. I think we got a big problem on the calling, the conference number. I'm not hearing anything. It's all garbled. Okay, if anybody can hear, I'm going to have to call back in. Let's let everybody else join back in. Hold on.
Huh? I'm back.
All right.
Yeah, something happened.
Okay. Yeah, we're waiting for people to join.
Oh, okay. Thank
you. Sorry. Cal, Doug, you back on?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let me just try to clarify again. If something, after something exists, it's gone. So, meaning the person. So the person's not there anymore. So you can't say, well, at least he had a good existence. So for himself, are we clear at least on that step? That since that person is no longer in existence, we can't talk about that person. It's like he never existed. That's because we know that the soul does exist. But we're talking about a scenario that if there is no continued soul,
talk about them because they did exist. What we can't say is that they have any joy from what they accomplished.
Well, that's the point of the rabbis. It's like they never existed.
Right.
Right. So that's the first point. That's the most important point here.
That's a great point.
Okay, so that's what I was saying. So that's why I was saying that we should realize that the physical existence itself is really nothing unless there is the soul. And we say, since there is a soul, so that's the real benefit to a person, that they have a continued existence. So that's just getting back to a verse. So that's why Kehelet says in 1:3 that what purpose is there to the person with all of his labor that he toils under the sun, meaning in his physical existence. If that's all it is, if that's the entire worth, so that's useless.
I just don't understand where they leap to the conclusion that it's worthless.
Well, he's saying that if you come to an end, so then you're like you never existed.
Well, if somebody makes a 57 Chevy, it eventually comes to an end, but I don't think that I'd say that then it was completely worthless only because it comes to an end.
All right, so let's use a person. So what worth it is there to the person then if he exists and then he completely leaves the existence, including his soul?
Well, he has an existence. He affected some people. He positively affected the world. He had some enjoyments. He had some learning experiences.
But yet again, I think the mistake is that you're saying that there is no he anymore. No, I agree with you. What else is the worth? Go ahead.
So the point is, we talk about his life and his effect and the decisions he made and the impacts of those decisions on the Jewish nation and so forth.
Right, because since people do have an eternity to their soul, so we speak about him now because it benefits our soul, which is eternal. But it's all predicated on the fact that the soul is eternal.
Well, okay. I disagree with that point. It seems like that's a definition being added after the fact. No conversation I've ever had with anybody about Moses has been... The reason we're considering this is because Moses is supposedly living forever.
I agree with that point. But I'm saying there's another thing, which is why we talk about him. And that's because the ideas that we learn from him are affecting our soul, which is eternal.
So then the answer must be that it's all for the purpose of the sake of the existence of the world, no matter who anybody, who the he is, it's all for God. It's all... Everything is for God. Hashem is one. That we're all participating in the fact and acknowledgement that God is one. That there is no he.
Well, you're getting a little bit too... That's really off. The point is that since there is... That people do have eternal lives, so Moses for himself still exists, and he will forever. Right? And his learning that we talk about, it's not because we're talking about him... In the next world, we enjoy the studies because it affects our soul, and it's something which we see as a real truth, and it affects our eternal soul too. So that's what the value is. Again, the whole question we're having here is, what is of value? What is there? What benefit? What is really the benefit to man? It's the most primary question, and that's what King Solomon opened his book with. That where is the real benefit? So it's not in the temporal existence of man on earth, because if we just look at that as man's entire existence and then it comes to a screeching halt and then there's no person anymore, so he might as well have never existed if it comes to an end. But since he doesn't come to an end, so then what a person does here is good for his soul, and whatever good he leaves over, it helps other people's souls. And Moses does say it. He tells the people, God's placing before you the life and death. He talked about. He told the people. It's in the verses. And you should pick life. The way we pick life, everybody knows that you die. So Moses was not talking about physical life when he said keep the Torah. He was telling them that. And the Talmud also quotes numerous verses where it talks about that there's an eternity to this all. The only thing is that there's a very big problem with making the focus of life the eternal world. And here's the problem. And we may have discussed it. That is that if you make the Torah's focus the next world, so then people are going to be abandoning Torah learning for the enjoyment's sake, and now they're just imagining some great reward they're going to get in the next world, so they just will go through the actions. But that happens. If that happens, so then they're not going to be spending the time enjoying the wisdom, which is the only thing that gives you the next world. So it's a catch-22. If you talk about the next world, so then people get so excited about that, because then that becomes the focus. They'll start realizing that it's temporary here. And then they'll lose all their interest in focusing in on spending time and learning and enjoyment of the ideas and debating it and discussing like we're doing right now. And then we'll just be imagining some reward we're going to get in this next world, and that's going to capture our focus, and we'll never spend the proper time needed to really enjoy wisdom. So you can't have the focus of the Torah being the next world. So what you have to have the focus as, but you also can't talk about it, you can't completely obscure it. So the approach of the Torah tanks is to speak about it very minimalistically.
Rabbi?
One second. So the point is that by the Torah not focusing on this image of the next world, and it talks about the wisdom and all the commands, and the Talmudic tractates are filled with debates and discussions, and it allows a person to engage in the actual pursuit of wisdom for the wisdom's sake. Now a person, without the carrot dangling in front of his face, now he can be focused on a daily basis in the here and now about a certain idea, this law, this idea, this concept, and discuss it for hours and really enjoy wisdom. Then by doing so, he attains the next world, because now he's attaching himself to eternal ideas, to truths that really improve his soul. So that's the compromise that the Torah took in terms of, you know, how its approach had to be. Doug, tell me what you think.
Say, Rabbi, that...
Wait, I said it's Doug. I was answering Doug, so let him respond. And then I'll take your question.
Well, it sounds to me like you're kind of fucking out of both sides of your mouth there.
No, that... Yeah,
go. Or the Torah's position is, it's saying, well, your life is useless without the world to come. Nothing really matters. There's no value. But... I want you to be involved in the world of ideas and learning, but I want you to do it not because of this next world, so I'm going to not say much about the next world, so that I want you to be involved in stuff here and now, but the stuff here and now really makes no sense unless we focus it on the next world.
Right, so you are told about both, but the weight is placed on the wisdom itself. Because without the wisdom, the soul doesn't live. Without a person living his life and engaging in it, all his actions are guided by all the mitzvot and all the laws. So then, if he's not doing that, so then he will not have the next world. You can't just say, here's the next world, you're going to get it, without doing anything. There has to be a focus on how is the soul, what nourishes the soul, basically. That's engaging in the life of wisdom. A person who's hedonistic and pagan, he's not going to have a soul when he expires. There's nothing that can sustain the soul. So it's not talking outside of both sides of my mouth. It's telling you that in order to achieve the real good that man can have, he has to engage in thought for the sake of it. That's called learning lishma, learning for the sake of the enjoyment itself. But that can only take place if you're not being misled by this promise that's such a glaring statement throughout the entire Torah, this promise of this great reward, that'll just steer people off the path. So it's there, it exists. The philosophers knew that the soul exists after death. And the Torah approaches it the proper way, and it gives the right balance. That's why it even says in Kohelis that God planted the world in man's heart. God knew that, that is verse 3:11. You see that God understood this. So he gave man a sense of immortality. Because if a person thinks he's going to die tomorrow, that's another problem. He's not going to put energy into his life. Is that 3:11? Let's make sure I'm giving you the right one.
There are a lot of people who think they're dead when they're dead, and they still put a lot of energy in their lives.
There's a lot of people who think they're dead when they're dead? What do you mean?
Well, you said that if a person doesn't have that promise of something beyond, they're not going to put any energy in their life.
Yeah, that's why we are told about it, but it's not made the focus. We have to know that this is not the entire existence of man. That's exactly what King Solomon is saying every single time he says, under the sun. He ridicules X because under the sun. Meaning, as long as you think that that's the entire value, that's the problem is with that, because you're assessing man's existence as being only earthly and nothing more. So he's trying to show you, no, it's not. If your values will be proper if you understand that there's an additional existence to man, which is the primary existence.
But what I'm saying is that there are tons of people out there who do not accept that there's a world to come, and they are still putting a lot of energy into their lives.
Right, because they think they're going to live forever. That's the other mistake. There's the immortality fantasy. Yeah, people could die left and right of me, but I don't think I'm going to die. Person doesn't really accept that. That's why they're so motivated to work. And people that are making billions of dollars and they're killing themselves and stressing themselves out, why are they doing that? It's because of this fantasy. They can't spend that money in their lifetime.
I think that you may find that there are actually people out there who do fully accept that they are going to die, but it doesn't cause them to lay down and just do nothing.
That's very few people. I'm just responding to your point. What motivates people in general, even without this concept of the next world? That's because they think this world doesn't end. I'm not going to die. I'm immune to that club. That what?
That all the people out there who don't accept the Torah have an improper idea of immortality.
Ask them. My source will be their real statement. Look at their expression when you ask them, do you honestly feel you're going to die? You're going to see a very stunned look on their face. Very few people really ponder that and want to think about it. It's something which disturbs people who are living just for this world. If they're really forced to do it, so then all of a sudden they're going to be shocked. You know, I never really stopped and thought, because they're driven every day, the next vacation, the next possession, the next acquisition, the next dinner, the next, you know, whatever it is, it's always the next thing here. That's where the motivation comes from. That's exactly what the immortality fantasy is. And that's what the King Solomon says there in verse 3:11. And he says that everything is done in its right time. Also, the world is planted in their hearts that they should not know the matter. From the beginning to end. They should know what God does from beginning to end. End meaning death. Yeah, these are the most primary of considerations, the primary elements of the human condition. Ambition. Hi. Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I see that you're getting to the end of the time period.
Yep.
I just wanted to make a suggestion that the primary, the cutting to the chase, would you say or agree or have a source that the basic purpose or what this might allude to is that it's to love and fear God? those two things. That it's beneficial for a man in his soul. Is what he's here is to build the love and fear of God.
It's true. I think it's too broad of a statement in terms of responding to what really would be a good response to this, though. You're right. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to that, that's after we've gone through and accepted and, you know, really feel convinced of certain steps along the way that they're really true. They have to be true to us. They have to be real to our minds and our, you know, our we have to embrace it emotionally, too. But that only happens once, you know, we see something clear intellectually. Then we can embrace it emotionally. So it's important that we spend the time in this and that we really, really understand how the human condition is.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Each step is very important along the way.
I know it's a mouthful of a statement, but...
Yeah, it is.
For hours and hours on just that alone.
Oh, yeah. All right, so let's, why don't we think it over? Let me just see, Doug, is there a follow-up on that? I know that you're still, you know, in disagreement, but let me just see if there's any, if we can just crystallize what we have to work on that for next week. I mean, for 2 weeks from now.
Well, if I'm understanding it right, then the summary would be that you're holding that a person's life makes any difference to them is... fact that possibility there's an eternal existence afterwards, and I'm arguing that there are a lot of people who don't hold that but still find meaning in their lives despite that.
I agree with you that people do disagree with that and they find meaning. But we have to, again, be clear that we're talking about two different points in the existence of a person. During the life was what you're talking about, and I'm talking about after the life is over. So we're not arguing if we're talking about two different points in their existence. I would agree with you that if we move that pendulum back to where they're in the middle of their life, do they find meaning? Yes. The question is whether after it's over, and if we say the soul does not exist, can we say that there was any meaning whatsoever? And I'm saying that since the person in our scenario does not exist anymore, the soul is also gone, according to the way we're constructing our case. So then there's nothing, there's no person to speak of anymore after their death to say that they had a good life. There's no they anymore. The he is gone. So I can't make a statement, at least he had a good life, if there's no he anymore. This is what I'm talking about.
But if there's a world to come, you can't really make that statement either, can you?
Because no, if there's a world to come, then I can make a statement that he had a good life and he's having a good life too. I can say both. If there's a world to come, that means that his soul is enduring. So there's still the he still exists. It's only the person whose soul is lost that you can't speak of him anymore. That's why the rabbi said it's like a person who never existed. Meaning, is something enduring or not? If something is not enduring, so if something never existed, let's say we'll call X the thing that never existed, and we'll call Y a person who lived for 1,000 years, right? Now, Y is now dead, and there's no soul anymore. So the rabbi is saying Y is now equal to X, because either one is a non-existent thing right now. It's not enduring, it does not exist, period. The difficulty is that trying to digest that all the good and the span of time of 1,000 years, how can we just discount it? That's very harsh on our emotions to say. But we have to really be objective. And I said at the outset that this is a very, it's not an easy concept. I think it's one of the most difficult I've come across. But I do see that if something is not continuing, so really it doesn't exist. So it's as if it never existed. because there's the he is gone. It's only when you have something or when you have a person that continues, then there was a purpose to life. Because now everything in life contributed to the soul state now that endures forever. All right, let's give it some thought. If you want to talk about it during the week, let me know. All right, so we'll resume 2 weeks. All right, we'll go through. All right, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody, have a good week.
Good week.
Okay, thanks.
Bye, everybody.